Dr. Marta Gonzalez is one of the scholars that to me has been able to connect both her artivism, being an artista, being an activist, to her scholarly work in ways that doesn't lower the value in any way, but actually just the opposite. It shows us that being able to combine this really raises the standard. And I throw in the fact that she's a Grammy award-winning musician, not because that is like her highest accomplishment, but rather because it's like one of many accomplishments that she actually rarely mentions. That in another world and other people's worlds, like maybe in a musician world solely, that would be the first thing you mention. But because she is such a kind of really like comprehensive and complete person and scholar, it's not necessarily at the top of your list. So she's a percussionist. She has this project called Entre Mujeres, where she's really using music as a way to both write music, but also to come up with new theories. And today her presentation is going to be Collective Songwriting, Testimonio, Theory, and Knowledge Production. And tomorrow there's going to be another presentation called Agonistic Harmony. We have some youth coming from the South Side tomorrow, so it might be a place where different types of learning take place. We might combine some songwriting also. And then on Thursday, we're hoping that the seminar can actually kind of become a songwriting workshop. So things that you'll hear today, you can practice, or you can see what it actually looks like in action. So thank you so much for accepting our presentation in March in Madison. But it's an honor to have you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you, Dr. Sarmiento, for inviting me and for keeping me appraised of everything that the center is doing. I looked at the roster and I was like, I'm hoping that what I offer here today and how I talk about this thing that I'm doing would be useful in some way, or I can contribute to the wonderful things that you guys have already been doing. So I am going to start off. This is the title of my talk today. I'm going to start off by actually going directly to an actual video that I wanted to show you guys to kind of start it off with. I'll let it play for a bit, and then we're going to, I'm going to go to the very end and play some of that. So, piece of the song you just heard is called Lights On, of course, Lights On, and it was created via the collective songwriting method. The song helps make legible federal grant funding meant for underrepresented communities in the state of California. It is meant to benefit English language learners and to foster growth and access to youth and low-income students. The local control funding formula, or the also known as the LCFF, will not be appropriately distributed if the schools and communities cannot collectively demand and articulate what they want to do with this money. Unfortunately, the status quo has been to allocate this funding to hire more school police, but that's not necessary. The real need is to hire more school counselors, currently in some public schools, 1,000-to-1 ratio. And restorative justice programming, that's also very much needed, not to mention arts curriculum that could benefit underprivileged students. I was hired by the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, or ACTA, to facilitate a collective songwriting workshop with LAUSD school administrators, the parents you see here, the students, and the teachers, in order to get all parties involved in having conversations around this LCFF funding. What you just saw was a video of the final product, right? The lights on video. What the video does not demonstrate is the important process, right? The conversations and envisioning that took place via the making of this composition. The community organizers of the LCFF campaign via schools work group realized that the legal federal jargon had to be dismantled in such a way as to make the conversation less daunting for the community. They knew they needed to find a way to allow for immigrant parents and their children to engage in such a conversation. The schools knew that they needed something other than the boardroom conversation or the school committee meetings to inspire people to engage in this process, right, to claim that money. So often, the language of power is meant to mask and or deter those affected from participating. Legality in the form of language and bureaucracy is often the greatest deterrent, and ACTA, in collaboration with the California Endowment, was given funding to pull on local artists and musicians to create these spaces of dialogue. This is where I, along with my partner Quetzal Flores, came in. We utilized this collective songwriting method on two separate occasions, once with administrators and another with students. The video is footage of different parts of the process and as well as the final outcome. So the song begins, that this is lyrics that they put together themselves. So they're asking, where does all this money go, right? They're really questioning, right, to our children, bureaucracy, to the fat cat. And so this is all part of the kinds of conversation that we had, like, and all of this took place in Spanish, of course, but a lot of them, the students, and later on the song is actually more bilingual, but for the most part, it's in English, and they're really trying to look at how this money isn't really meant to serve the community and what they're trying to do by claiming it, right? And use it for better. And so Lights On is actually an expression that we have in, how many of you speak Spanish here? Is that? Okay. Oh, excellent. Okay, so Lights On means what in Spanish? What is, in terms of a light bulb? Okay, so there's an expression that we say, se me prendió el foco, right? And so one of the ladies used that expression in saying that, you know, we gotta, que se te prenda el foco means like you gotta wake up to the reality of what's happening. And so that's where that whole idea comes from. But the Lights On video will be circulated on the internet and be used to continue to advocate for the proper implementation of LCFF. So this is being used by the community for the community, right? In this case, it was used, the process itself involved a dialogue, right, with the community. Having the opportunity to facilitate collective songwriting methods towards these kinds of ends continues to be one of the ways that validates my life and skills as a professional and community musician. As a singer and songwriter for a band, Quetzal, I've traveled the world as a professional community and as a community musician. Music experienced on many fronts, sites, and social locations has demonstrated to me that music can exist in numerous ways. Some of my musical experiences early in life have been oppressive, quite frankly, and have left imprints of shame and trauma in my memory. There have also been those like LCFF or Fandango Praxis, for example, that have allowed me to see how music could be a liberatory process and a deliberate act of love and source of empowerment for oneself and community. Music in this sense is a conduit of freedom, a tool that is malleable by the will and hands of those who envision emancipatory change. As an active musician in professional and community practice for nearly 20 years, my academic work looks at the ways in which community groups utilize music and alternative art dialectics as repositories of collective memory, as sites of political mobilization, and as tools for calling communities into being through participatory music and dance practices. As a scholar and artivista, or artist activist, realms of artistic activity that are often relegated to the status of community-based art making, to me, represent efforts that challenge oppressive neocolonial historical, social, and ideological paradigms. As a new assistant professor for Scripps College, I brought some of my music skills and community organizing methods, such as these, and into my process of and teaching. Today, I'm going to share with you this collective songwriting process, the potential I see in it, and the different spaces we have implemented this method towards different ends. I want to share with you the history of this method, the different stages of the process, and the significance it has had in Chicano Latino communities in East LA. My guiding question is posed by Black feminist scholar Mako Fitz. I'm going to do what I do to my students. Okay, can somebody read this for me? Anybody?
Imagine community may sustain discursive modes of transformation, but how does it contend with the real everyday practice of community building?
Yes, this is Mako Fitz. So I believe that music can be wielded as a transformative process based on the everyday practice of community building, right? So how many of you have listened to a song and it makes you cry, has made you want to cry, right? How many of you have listened to a song and it to get yourselves hyped up? Yeah. How many of you have listened to a song and and it informed you about something that you didn't quite know about till you went ahead and looked it up? It actually prompted you to do further research. How many of you have listened to a song and it makes you horny? No, that's terrible. I shouldn't say that. Okay, maybe it was just me. But we can agree that a song, right?
I'm about to raise my hand.
I saw you raise your hand. But we
don't
but
play
we
it now, though.
right. Anything by Marvin Gaye, right? No, but a song, we can agree that a song is a sonic and literary manifestation, is life soundscape, a unique cathartic memento, right? A powerful political tool. And a song can also be an important historical text, right? A person's, let's say, testimonio, right? Or their testimony, their life views, their triumphs, their aphorisms, their struggles can be expressed in song lyrics, right? In this way, song lyrics can transmit ways of knowing. It's a way of theorizing about life in general. And it can also be viewed as alternative ways of creating knowledge, right? When practiced in community, songwriters together, a community writing a song together, can be a really powerful exercise in consensus building and collective knowledge production, right? So I say that after many times after many moments of having this collective songwriting process, these are some of the steps that I see in the process itself, and that hopefully you will get to witness with me on Thursday. And that there's testimonio, right? Meaning that people are sharing part of their lives, maybe an experience that they had. And of course, we learn from the listening as well, right? So there's sharing, and there's also, you're also listening to somebody sharing a story of theirs, right? This creates a kind of dialogue, right? On whatever it is that you're trying to write about, that initiates a kind of healing process oftentimes, right? And collective knowledge is gathered via song based on these discussions. There's a whole process and ways in which we do this. And then all of which intrinsically, at the very end, builds a kind of community out of us, right, in that very special moment. So all that being said, collective songwriting as a process and method creates space, challenges multiple patriarchal systems, builds community, and can potentially produce knowledge that is accessible to communities beyond the academy by virtue of just being a song, right? It gets shared, it gets played. One of the most important aspects of this process is this idea, and what is centered in it is this embodied knowledge, right? And the idea that whoever shows up in the room and is participating brings their social, their cultural, their life experience as we approach a dialogue table, right? In this way, this method has been useful in many spaces for its ability to be inclusive of any and all who come to the dialogue table, right? So I've utilized this space In many moments. One of them has been the Entre Mujeres project that Professor Sarmiento just mentioned. It was translocal feminine composition, was formally initiated in Veracruz, Mexico, from fall of 07 to summer of 08. And projects also Art in the Park in East Los Angeles, in Washington State, at the Seattle World School, which I'll talk about today, and the King County Youth Detention Centers as well. So, And this method was effective in all of these communities. And before I go into specifics, I think it's really important that we consider the roots and the impetus of this method and the ways in which we're using it now. And one of them in the collective songwriting method, and specifically the ways in which it has been developed and was inspired directly from the legacy of the Chicano movement, right? The roots and inceptions. I don't have to tell you guys here what the Chicano movement was, right? Sociopolitical identity, room 1960s, the Chicano movement, the movimiento, right? And what's important about this is the utilize various forms of resistance to reach social, political, and economic inclusion in mainstream society, not the least of which was art, right? Music, teatro was extremely important, and other forms of creative expression in ways in which you could reach communities, you could inform them of the important topics that were being discussed, what was being fought for. Art, and specifically teatro, is one of the most famous, and of course visual art, muralism, was extremely important in reaching a critical mass of people. But for the collective songwriting method, we can fast forward. There have been many indigenous uprisings that have inspired, and the one of the most important ones that was relevant to us and as young people in college was the 1994 Zapatista movement, that uprising that happened in January 1st, 1994, where the Mayan Zapatista uprising is a result of the resistance to neoliberalism, globalization, and particularly the North American Free Trade Agreement, was inspiring to the Chicano Latino community in East Los Angeles. The EZLN, or the Ejército Zapatista de Liberación Nacional, was less about building an army and more about civil society in support of a way of life free of ties to Western economic and social paradigms. In 1997, so Chicano movement, the Zapatista movement, extremely inspired, very much inspired this very important moment in 1997 when 120 Chicano artist activists, primarily from East Los Angeles, organized and engaged in the Primer Encuentro Chicano Indígena por la Humanidad y contra el neoliberalismo. That's a much younger, my partner Quetzal Flores and I, where this encuentro was transformative because it demonstrated to us many things. There were 5 days of discussion. Throughout these 5 days, some of the first things that would happen was very important dialogues, but at the end of every day, the goal was to create something artistic, right? Whether it was painting, a mural painting, the topics based on that, songwriting, dances, poetry, and the goal was to create it collectively. So this encuentro was transformative because it demonstrated to us, one, how music and or art could serve as tools of dialogue, and two, how the process of collective communal engagement drew out multiple subjectivities between Chicano and Mayan participants. Through an engagement of collective artistic processes throughout the encuentro days, poetry, collective songwriting, teatro and dance, our differences were highlighted and deconstructed. A creative convivial space engendered important dialogues. In this encuentro, music was not just a messaging tool or a sonic vessel you fill with political content, but rather a process and a means by which you could engage diverse communities like Mexicanos, Chicanos, Latinos, and various indigenous groups in transformative discussions. New ways of envisioning individual and collective futures. In this case, the future of indigenous communities in the mountains of Chiapas, which they're still going strong, and the future of Chicano communities in East Los Angeles barrios, and that's questionable. But music became an important tool either way, and it was one of the first and only encuentros of this time period that did not center academics or talking heads, great analysis on globalization, but rather dialogue centered on creative processes intended to prompt different kinds of outcomes. It was the first time we engaged in a collective songwriting method as Rosa Marta, who you see here, Rosa Marta, who's in the white dress there, really took charge and got all of these different indigenous groups that spoke different languages along with the Chicanos that showed up, and we would talk about our realities in the barrios and healthcare and gender rights and all of these different things as well as the indigenas, and we just kind of had a general dialogue on how these powers were coming down on us and what we could do differently to change our realities. So Rosa Marta Zarate facilitated this first session juggling communication among three indigenous languages, Spanish and some English speakers, the themes, we agreed on themes, we discuss, we break them, then we would create music or all of these other creative products afterwards. Most importantly, upon returning from the 1997 Encuentro, the newly titled or self-identified social artivistas began to generate collective and creative work utilizing social techniques developed in conversation with Maya communities in their own barrios. So one of the things that was most important is to the ways in which we had always been a kind of band that performed on stage. This experience in the mountains of Chiapas really got us to think about how music could be used in other ways, right? In creating with the Zapatistas, we realized that it wasn't just about us being musicians and sort of filling our music with all these political messages and getting out there, and that was enough for us. We realized that we needed to get our hands dirty, that we needed to be more in the community and utilize our skills. And so we quickly, we continue to perform and record our music, but most importantly got us to really think about shift our consciousness from product-based music making to think about music as a tool of dialogue, think about it less as a messaging tool and more as a way of convivencia, or to be with, very much present with the community, to engage in this process or perhaps develop this process, this important process. So convivencia, literally meaning to live with, is a deliberate and profound act of being present to each other. And I think that music is really one of the things that helps us, that is easy to engage communities with, and to really get them to think outside of what we're living, and to be able to dream as well. So convivencia, ultimately, via music practice, decenters our understanding of the commoditization of music, right? Where oftentimes what we can think about for most young people, I don't know about your students, but for most of the time, our experience in music and Western practices, with few exceptions, is that you buy or you sell it, right? Rarely is it something that we do together in community, right? No matter the levels of musicianship, right? Or you have to be a musician to engage in community with others, right? And that's not really, we don't have cultures that center us around the convivencia with music. Convivencia music practice also centers the sociality of sound, where it makes the gathering and process of playing music together more important than the actual outcome, right? Convivencia makes for dialogue, and thus it builds community. So as I stated earlier, music in our society and for many young people nowadays is primarily understood as a product, something you buy or sell, and with few exceptions, music is ever really about being in dialogue with one another. So thinking about the entire process, as a convivencia act, I come to find the different stages, once again, that have revealed itself over time. And again, I'd like to focus a little bit on this idea of the testimonio. One of the most important aspects of the collective songwriting process for me has been the centering of the testimonio, right? And what people have to offer when they come to the table. Testimonio has been an important intervention in an effort to decenter subjective knowledge and Western research paradigms that often other communities of color. Testimonio centers firsthand knowledge and experience as an invaluable resource and a place from which knowledge can be formulated. In this way, testimonio has been recognized as a powerful research praxis for people of color. Testimonios, when shared in a community, may also initiate what indigenous scholar Sean Wilson cites as relationality, which results from moments of sharing and healing. Citing relationality as part and parcel to an indigenous ontology, Wilson states that, quote, rather than viewing ourselves as being in relationship with other people or things, we are the relationships that we hold and are a part of. To this end, we must recognize not only the importance of sharing one's testimonio through the collective songwriting process, but also the aspects that are generated in the process and thus allow for this kind of relationality. For Rina Benmayor, testimonio has been a voice that is oppositional or propositional, right? So the whole idea is that as we're sharing, we're also sort of, perhaps we're challenging some of the ideas that are being put forth, right? It involves an urgent voice of resistance, as she states, and to social injustices, an urgency to speak out a collective interlocutor in a collaborative process of production and interpretation. So testimonial is important, right? So I want to share with you quickly how testimonial was important in this collective of Entre Mujeres, which is this transnational dialogue that was started via the fandango, a fandango which is participatory music and dance practice native to the state of Veracruz, this network of people that engaged in this community practice. And together, we decided to have these collective songwriting workshops where we all basically participated and decided to write music collectively, formulate these lyrics collectively. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about this song called Sobreviviendo. So testimonio was utilized in the Entre Mujeres project as a way to create knowledge through and theory through personal experiences toward the goal of creating songs, or what I began to see as sung theories. It became a space from which to discuss and create collective ideas among women, which simultaneously created a sense of community among all mujeres involved. As windows to the mind and soul, lyrics often focused on women's sharing of embodied knowledge as well as their community knowledge. They talked about mothering, about giving birth, the birthing process, were common topics throughout the Entre Mujeres project. However, the sharing of community knowledge and migration experience was also expressed, as in Sobreviviendo, or as I'll show you just a little bit. Look, these are in English, but the song is in Spanish. By a woman named Silvia Santos from Jalapa, Veracruz. The lyrical and poetic composition of Sobreviviendo incited dialogue around migration experience. But this initial topic generated deeper conversations around nation, country, place, mass exodus, crossing, and the possibility of return. With an understanding that music is a public sound source can potentially inform beyond borders, one of the participants, Silvia Santos, co-wrote the song with the deliberate intention of sonically reaching migrant families and families on the U.S. side of the border. Sobreviviendo and the process of engaging in the composition generated a physical, spiritual, and ideological space from which participants were able to theorize and imagine new realities for themselves and their families. Indeed, the testimonials and dialogue around the migration experience gave way to poetic prose that predicated hopes and fashioned new visions for a more just future for migrants. So Silvia was really adamant about writing about migration, and that was her whole thing. Like, I want to be able to write it. I know people in California can listen to it, and they have to know that the folks that stayed back in Mexico are also losing something in that. We're doing the work of all the absent folks that are leaving, right? So that was her. She was really adamant about it. The collective songwriting method was also conducted at the Seattle World School, where we had 5 days actually, where we went in and we worked with youth. And the Seattle World School is actually has immigrant youth from all over, from Ecuador, Honduras, Guatemala, different parts of Africa, as well as I believe also we had Russian, Ukraine students from the Ukraine. And so the idea for the Seattle World School is that they really wanted to talk about bullying, because as immigrant youth, they constantly got bullied. And so we went in and had 5 days of just trying to create as many songs as possible. Every day was a workshop. And the students were really active. Like any high school student, some were into it, some weren't as into it. But eventually, everybody was participating, and they really wrote things down. And what one of the main things they wanted to talk about, again, was the dialogue on bullying in schools and what they wanted, why they think the bullying is happening. And so if you see in this, some of this sort of brainstorming, they were like, there's racism, there's, the older's picking on the younger, and there's age difference, gender, right? And so all of these, they're articulating all of these different things, and then at some point they wrote respect in all of their different languages, which was really great, and they got to sort of share some of those, sort of what respect meant in every language. And there were different perspectives about what respect was, right? And so, that sort of happened. There were deeper reflections than what was just there. And then, of course, there were moments where we had them, and this is something we added later, where we had the students like, okay, how did it go today? Can you guys write this stuff down? And so they'd sit down and they'd write some of the reflections that they thought about and what they liked about it, what they didn't like, what they would have changed. And of course, as you're having the collective songwriting method and you're generating all these ideas, you have the musicians off to the side sort of beginning to generate these sonic influences, right? By then we've gotten a tally of who likes what kind of music. We're kind of trying to cater a little bit to some of their styles of music. And so when the music starts up, if things get a little too slow, then the music plays and, their energy is kind of picked up. And so the live music was really helpful. And of course, one of the first thing we like to do is really sort of get a tally of the audience, not the audience, but participants, and say, who knows how to play anything? Who likes to sing? Who likes to, I can kind of play this, but not really. Bring your instrument. If we got enough warning, we ask people to bring their instruments. If we don't, we just sort of get whatever's out there, which is great. It's always useful. And some people pick up new instruments just for the hell of it, and they're actually become pretty good at it. But again, people end up sharing a lot. People end up sharing a lot of what they live. And as immigrant youth, some of the strife, some of the stories of crossing were also shared, which is takes a lot of a safe space to do that oftentimes, right? So the testimonial part was always present. And then, of course, as we're trying to come up with these songs, and I want the chorus to go here, I want this to go there, all of that is sort of like competing ideas, but always fun. So this is a reflection by Jasmine. And Jasmine recognized how music was an important tool at arriving to a relational moment with others in her group, as I had mentioned earlier about relationality. She says that the process of this song took as place as a group. We all gave our point of view, and this helped us become companions in the process. In my case, I got to meet new people, and it was very enjoyable. The lyrics of this song identifies us because each of us has something in common, and one thing among them is music. We are here because of music, and that's Jasmine, who shared a little bit of, didn't mind me taking a picture of it. Oftentimes at the end, which although I don't encourage product, right, like whether or not we came up with the song, I know that for youth, like finishing something is really important, right? So, and oftentimes they always want to like, let's record, let's make a CD, we can start a band, right? And I'm like, that's not the point. The point is that, we're engaging in this process. Look at all this stuff we talked about. This is amazing. And so then usually they're like, oh yeah, that was pretty cool, okay. But in this case, for the Seattle World School, we ended up having a performance for them and for the community. And of course, everybody came out, their parents, and they were really happy to share what they had. Right. And so, so this is youth that are in high schools, their whole lives ahead of them. But we've also done this with youth that have maybe got caught up in a little bit of trouble. And so I want to share that with you now. Everybody sing that for me, please. Nice and loud.
I'm recycling our bad ways to make some better days.
This is their lyrics, okay. I didn't write that. This is what they wrote. So all of this music is there.
Again, nice and loud. I'm recycling our bad ways to make some better days. It's a recycling world.
And when we're recording, don't come up with your
you're listening, okay? We'll listen to that afterwards, okay? Focused on what we're doing right here, and then we'll come out of that.
We're in the King County Juvenile Detention Center with Sounds Beyond Barriers, which is a collective songwriting project engaging youth as well as teaching artists from Los Angeles and Seattle.
It's a cycle, right? The collective song.
So this is 5 days. We had to go into this. It's not a third level, but it is like a second tier. Detention facility, we had to go in there. We did about 5 days, and we got to go home every time. It took about an hour to get through, and then, you know, quicker to get out. But 5 days, and we came up with 3 songs, so I'm going to share with you. And they wanted to record it because we wanted to get a little CD for them so they could take it when they were released. Some of them were released before, but the ones that you see here today. So they came up with all of this music, all of the lyrics, and just... The chorus they come up with, we had a whole discussion. They all went off and did their thing. They would come back and ask for, you know, some guidance. But for the most part, this is them theorizing about their own realities, right? This is them sort of coming up with some of the things that they how they understand the system, right? How it's working. And hopefully all of this really was really a moment for them to think about music as a way of sort of outside of this idea that they're going to you know, become big time or big MCs or anything like that. It was a different way of thinking about it, and none of them had ever written before, and some of them found this moment for themselves I haven't been keeping in touch with some of them, but hopefully some of them continue to play. But I know for the most part, they all said, like, this was amazing. I want to keep writing. I know writing is something I want to do. And I want to, you know, share it with others as well. And so we were able to record some of it and give it back to them so that they have something to remember some of the discussions that we had with them. So ultimately, this entire process is a moment in which communities can create and inhabit meaningful space, even while incarcerated. Gay Teresa Johnson has articulated how, quote, meaningful space is essential for the survival of communities, but also for the discursive practices encoding the stories that define and redefine who people are, where they fit into the world, and what they envision for the future. Spatial entitlement, a way in which marginalized communities have created new collectivities based not just upon eviction and exclusion from physical spaces, but also on new and imaginative uses of technology, creativity, and spaces. In many instances, overlooked by social historians, everyday reclamations of space, assertions of social citizenship, and infopolitic struggles have created the conditions for future successes in organized collective movements. Finally, similar to theories regarding testimonio, the most important aspect of collective songwriting is not the song itself, but rather its ability to engender solidarity. Collective songwriting as an enactment of spatial entitlement demonstrate the varying ways that the participants of Entre Mujeres, the LCFF, the communities there, the mothers, the students there, which was my first example, or the King County Jail Youth campaign created these spaces, right? These new collectivities in the face of adversity. So we can think about a collective songwriting as a kind of signature pedagogy of Chicano Artivistas. And to think about, these are some of the lyrics that I thought were, that they came up together with together. Traditionally applied to the profession of law, education, and medicine, signature pedagogies are acts that convey personality, methods of performance, and values of a field. In this way, collective songwriting is a signature pedagogy of Chicano studies. It is, and particularly Chicano Artivistas. It is a contribution to the field of music and Chicano Latino studies by Chicano Artivistas and artist activists who are actively using art mediums as tools of dialogue. Although I have mostly focused on the process, I consider the songs as archives or sung theories very important. They are important elements, especially when one considers their significance over time, for one. And at present, for example, the Entre Mujeres Recording Project stands as an archive that documents one of many translocal dialogues between Chicano communities and Chicana Latina and Mexicano communities in the U.S. and Jarocho communities in Veracruz, Mexico. The topics of these songs cover everything, again, from motherhood to migration. The Lights On video, for example, for the LCFF campaign is being circulated on the internet in order to continue to prompt dialogue around the federal monies, encouraging communities to stay active. Seattle World School students performed their songs for their families and community and brought much needed attention to the issues on campus, such as bullying and their education in college. Actually, I forgot to mention that they talked a lot about applying for college in their state, of even despite their immigration status. The core curriculum course, I've created a core curriculum course for my school at Scripps College where we engage in this process, and it has been repeating every fall since 2015. The King County Jail participants took with them a moment in time, a sonic reflection that might lower perhaps recidivism rates. Recording, lyrics, and performances of these songs stand to be remembered, revisited, reconstructed, critiqued, or honored by future generations. Songs and the theories embedded in them can inform across time, disciplines, borders, generations, and other ways of knowing. But most importantly, songs can register the hope and resilience that inspired their creation. That's one of the little guys that participated. That's it. Thank you, guys. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Any thoughts, critiques? Please, yes.
This is the most exciting presentation I've seen at the school in 5 years.
No, get out of here.
I've been for a few Pete notes.
I'll buy you a beer later.
I'll buy you. I'm so excited. I've never heard of any of this before, and you're introducing me to all new things. And so because I'm interested in, I've been doing fiber arts as community building and teaching people to knit for refugees and all kinds of things. We're teaching each other, refugees come, etc. And my question to you is the same kind of critique that I'm dealing with from academia. How do you find the most empowering response to those who would criticize this as not valid in some way, to those who might try to invalidate the intellectual, you see, rigor of all this, and you mentioned black feminism earlier, and all the things that help build this community of ideas, or do you think that,
Well, I think that as practitioners that are rooted in these practices, I think that it is our job to also challenge them about all the theorizing they do and not enough doing, right? There's a whole lot of this and not a whole lot of getting your hands dirty. And I think that one of the pushbacks that I try to do is to say, like, look, I do more than talk about it, right? I can theorize around it. I can pull in all of these different theories. The theory is there. But most importantly, and what we really want, if we really want to transform this world, is to engage, create more culture, right? And I don't mean culture. Culture is a loaded term, but create more process-based work that involves others, not just benefits ourselves, right? I think that the books and academia are really important. Obviously, I'm very much indebted to academia for giving me a steady paycheck, right? But I also think it's really important, and I will say that, but I think it's also really important that we stop, that we also stay rooted or stay focused on what's important, what will outlive us. And not just our books and our publications, but we need to find ways of really getting students to think about these other ways of transforming the world, right? And being that I'm an artist and a musician, my medium is music, right? But there's other, I would love to hear more about what you're doing. I know so many other people really asking this question of process-based work and us really critiquing capitalism in a way that, so one of the things that I think about is there are so many artists, I don't want to displace the importance that as artists when we produce political work, right, how important that is. That's still very important. I've been to concerts that have transformed my life and got me like, wow, like I'm inspired, I cry, like I come out of there pumped up. But I think it's also really important for us to use our skill set as musicians to find ways of engaging community and really building that, you know, that process such as this. I'm honing in on this, but there's other ways of doing it, right? And I don't have all the answers. But we need to reinstill that in communities and also to not make commoditizing our work so important, you know, because I think it derails us. The most political artwork out there can be sold. And I think that once it's out in the market in that way, it can lose its power, you know. So I guess my pushback for a lot of academics that might discredit some of this work or say it's not academic enough or whatever, I always say, like, well, I think there's enough theory out there and I'm offering something else. Or trying to bring an example to something else. Yes, sir.
Well, I guess I'd like to follow up on that question and ask it from the social science perspective.
Yes.
So what would be your criteria then for understanding the difference between music and the creation of music for the process you've just talked about? That is empowering and transformative, versus that's just entertaining or helps you dissipate your frustrations and you just feel better about it and that don't do anything. What is your criteria for knowing that these processes are actually working?
Okay, well, I think that I always know in the moment when it's happening, because you get a sense of there's a moment, and I hope if you're going to be around you, that you can say, and again, this is another thing that I'd like to put the value in the process itself and not so much the outcome, right? So that's, to me, that sort of signals, so I mentioned earlier that for the kids, like when they weren't finishing up a song, I would kind of kick my gears into the music making part. I was like, okay, they need a course and they can't come up with something, so maybe I'll help with this. And I would push them along so that they finish, because I know finishing something is important to them, right? They're like, oh, if they don't finish, they're like, oh, we suck with something else that I'm not good at, right? And especially as teenagers. So I made sure we finished. And then they feel like, hey, that was pretty good. We did, that was amazing, right? As the music is coming together, people are always like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. Like, so I know in the moment, the way people are paying attention, what's happening, right? How they're being affected. And initial reactions when people come up to me afterward and say, I've never done anything like that before. That was so much fun. That was really fun. And then for those who can handle it, when we're done with the song, oftentimes I was like, especially when they're adults, I say, hey, that was really cool. Check these lyrics out right here. Look at all this shit we said right here. How important that was. But I want you to look at every line and look at our brainstorming. Look at all the stuff we talked about. To me, that is more important. The process, the kind of dialogue we had in trying to build this song. This is really important. And this is like an archive to what we did. This is like a memory, like a snapshot. But to me, the most important part was that we, right here, we argued about this word right here. You said this, and that's it. Do you remember that? Remember that conversation? Okay. And then we went on and we discussed all this other stuff. Like, that, to me, is way more important than anything we could have come up with, because we never talk like that anymore, you know? And so I kind of try to give them both sides, right? The outcome is really important, and we're addicted to the outcome, right? But I want to get people, when we do these workshops, I really try to get people to sort of engage and reflect on the process more than anything. And if I've done that, it's already a success, even if we don't finish a song. Because people suddenly were in a moment with each other, and even if they disagreed, sometimes there are some moments that are so deep and so powerful, or people are arguing that I can't really control, I try to find ways of just mediating those energies. And anyhow, I don't know if I answered your question. Sorry. You have to stop me.
I mean, well, you know it, but how might someone else know it? How could somebody independently arrive to the same conclusion?
Ah, the social scientist, yes.
No, I mean, you know. You
so
know
you want
it,
me to quantify
but,
it.
But you know it in your heart. But
I also, I feel like, okay, so I get that. Yeah, we want to try to quantify that. But I think that there's something to be said, and this is the part of convivencia that I think is really important, for us to be so present to each other that we can tell. That we can human, on a human connection, like we can tell that we've connected with others. Now, I'm sure that's probably difficult to quantify, right? But you've had connections with people as a social scientist, right? And being in community or with the communities perhaps that you write about, or right? I think that we know when we've connected. And that's not something that anybody needs to tell us for us to really know. And then maybe we have different perceptions of it, right? But ultimately, I think that we have to be present enough to each other to know. And even if we don't know, at least we're having a conversation about it, you know? I don't know if that answers your question. Yes, sir.
One thing, you're drawing a distinction here between this kind of thing and commodified music. And one thing about commodified music is that it can go really fast, far, and wide. How important is it for this? Is it important for a process like this to try to match that, or is it important for a process like this to be something else?
Something else. We can't compete with the market system, you know? And I think that having intimate communities are what's going to save us, ultimately. I really believe that. I think that we tend to think big, supersize, and big, and bigger is better as something that can hurt us ultimately, and that is not sustainable ultimately. The world is built on relationships, and the more intimate we can make them in smaller communities, I mean, they don't have to be huge. And imagine communities, right? We could talk about Benedict Anders, and to think about that, right? We have all these imagined communities, but I think that ultimately it's the face-to-face sort of daily interactions that I think are also really important to cultivate, and to become stronger in those, right? And not make them so that they're stronger, and when we need them, they're there, you know? So I would say different. Yes?
So the beginning, when you showed lights on, it referred to Boyle Heights.
Yeah,
so the overarching title for your visit is about East LA trenches. And I wonder if you could say more about that community. And part of the reason I was looking up, when I first saw that, I pulled up my computer because I had to remind myself of the title and the time, but we had a visitor here, George Sanchez from
Professor Sanchez,
It's been 7 years, I discovered it was spring of 2011. And it was about Boyle Heights, and he had two talks, one of which was about the earliest 20th century and global migrations and how that made for a very multicultural community, which was like Eastern European, Jewish, and then, you know, the focus for the second talk was on the 60s and 70s and among high schoolers and the birth of the Chicano movement, but also tensions between Black and Latino. Mm-hmm. And one of the main points that he was stressing was how constant the change was. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's 7 years, maybe that's not a terribly long time, but I'm just curious to know, especially given East LA trenches in the title there. If you can say more about the story of Boyle Heights currently, how that played into the, sort of the bigger sort of social context of a changing place and what Boyle Heights is today and how that was reflected in that particular process as well as the...
In this?
Yeah.
Okay, absolutely. Yes, Boyle Heights is known as the quickest, like the changeover in ethnic breakdown has been,
it continues.
Yeah. But I think that it's been Latino and immigrant for, it's always immigrant, right? Right now, the biggest challenge, and ever since this is actually a couple years ago, but the biggest challenge right now is gentrification, right? And I don't know if George mentioned that, but it's huge right now. I mean, all central, you know, downtowns all over the country, that's what, you know, they're resegregating major cities, right? And Boyle Heights is no different. It's really close to downtown LA, and that has been the biggest struggle right now. And so I would say that LCFF comes in to a point where, you know, we were brought in, right? We didn't know about this effort. We didn't know about the funding that was coming in and was trickling down and how it wasn't being effective because the schools would filter it into the police, right? So our job was to go in and let the community know and let the señoras know, or the mothers, right, what was happening with this money and that they had a right to it, to buy books or to do whatever it is. Later on in the lyrics, they actually offer up like what they want to do with it, right? So there are so many efforts going on. Right now, our biggest fight is gentrification, and we've been working towards that in all these other spaces, in schools as well. But groups like these are also taking up gentrification, but also the LCFF funding. There's also the legalized street vending campaign. That's a whole other one. And all of it is really around sort of coming to support the work that the immigrants continue to try to do there. Everything from trying to hold on to their housing, to affordable housing, creating affordable housing, being heard by the school board, right, with efforts such as those. It still revolves around immigrants trying to survive, you know. And even if the face is changing of Boyle Heights, where you have a whole lot of, you know, gentrifiers, as they say, coming into the fold, I think that there's still a lot of immigrants that continue to live there, people that have been there for 30 plus years, you know. It's still an issue, and it's changing, but not as quickly as we might think, you know. Yeah, I don't know if I answered.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna mention Coco, the film. But
yeah.
Are we losing this? I sometimes feel like we're losing this battle around alternative spaces for cultural production. Like, because things are measured as the product, like, well, that, you know, that song makes me feel good, so why do I need to participate in this long, like, song-making, songwriting workshop and bringing together, and so much easier just to, like, purchase the album and listen to it and make me feel good too, you know? Like, or this is just so much easier to consume as an audience member. And I bring up Coco because I feel like...
Can you say what that is?
Coco is like this Disney production of Day of the Dead that came out.
It's a film based on Day of the Dead.
It's a film based on Day of the Dead by Disney. And
I really liked it.
So really big like cultural critics and like radical scholars like came out almost defending it, you know? And I haven't seen it, and I'm sure it's good. I'm sure people have that feel-good feeling, and maybe they feel empowered, like the Frida Kahlo Barbie. You know, like, maybe in some way, this purchasing of things that look like you do make you feel good.
Yeah.
But then there's this other alternative that's not commodified, that's not, it's even hard to quantify, as Beth points out, because it's like, well, where does it happen, or like, did you measure how many times they said empowered? Or, you know, it's like, how do you quantify it? And how do you actually sustain these spaces? You know, like, my question was kind of like, are we losing that battle? Like, is this cultural capitalism, you know, just gonna take over and consume all these, like, spaces? Or, you know, do you have to be able to sell your products in order to survive? Do you have to actually create the product so that the rest of the world sees it as worth something?
No, that's what I mean. I think that commodity-based culture is just a part of how we live. You know, I mean, there's no way. Maybe there is a way around it. That's not really what I'm concerning myself with as much as I am really tightening up the process. And so long as we always refer back to the process, I think that's the most important thing. We just keep signaling back to that. And I think nothing can take the place. I don't think there's ever anything in the world that will ever be able to take the place of building, of knowing how to build relationships. And that's something that I've brought up to the administration before when we talk about the core curriculum at my school, for example. I say, we teach them so much. And we're constant, you know, we're thinking about all the skill sets they need to do and learn, but we never focus on community building. Like, are people taught how to build, do we know how to build community? How do you build a relationship? I mean, I think we start when we're in kindergarten, right? How to be a good friend and how to, like, I mean, I don't know, but I mean, like, as adults, if we're going to talk about how viable our students are going to be when they get out into the workforce, one of the biggest things you could do and know how to do is build community. You know, if that's not a utility, I don't know what is, right? And even as we get more and more high tech, right? I'm going off on a tangent, but there's a reason for that. So I think that there's nothing in this world could offer up that will ever take the place of how just being able to hold relationships and hold space for relationships. And I think that as educators, I think that's what we do in the classroom, what we try to do in the classroom amongst all the other things that we're trying to get them to understand, right? But I, you know, it's fundamental to us as human beings, and if we lose that, you know, it's in us. It really is in us. It's how well we do it that is not good. And that's not to compete with commodity culture, right? We like our nice things. I loved seeing Coco. It made me cry. I thought it was wonderful, you know. I don't think it encompasses everything about being Mexican, but being Mexican is there's not just one way of doing it, right? So that was my critique. I was like, take it easy. This is one movie. Like, I enjoyed it. I'm glad that my son gets to watch it, you know. So I enjoyed it, but and I can see the critiques in it, but, you know, for the most part, you know, it's not holding all my value systems, you know. I don't think I did answer your question.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I just don't. I think we need to find more things like this. This is not. I'm not saying this is the answer to all our problems, but what I am saying is that it's important for us to create, rescatar, or like rescue certain processes that revolve around this kind of interaction with communities. There's also some that we need to invent, perhaps. There's ciphers, for example, hip-hop has ciphers. There's other cultures out there that do this, that we have this. This is fundamental to our human, like, way of being, interacting with each other. You know, we need to do it. Maybe somebody has an uncle who plays guitar and brings it out for Christmas or whatever, and that moment right there is what memories are made out of, right? Like, and I think that's really important, you know, that we begin to value those kinds of things and bring them back, restore them, dust them off, or create them anew, you know. Yes.
I have a question. I really love your framing around the process, because I study technology practices, mostly in Africa, but history of technology. And, you know, I guess the framing, so much of our, you know, contemporary conversations about what counts for knowledge and what counts is around, you know, science and technology. And there's so much about the parallels, I think, in art making, that are, one again, about process, you know, the sustained process that people engage in. And then there's, you know, these material outcomes, you know, in terms of music, product, and making instruments, you know. So, and so I see more resonance than I see, you know, things that have to fight against each other. But in terms of your, I'm going to ask a long-term question.
Yeah.
Your practice over the years, you know, exemplified by two of these examples, has also is processional. I think it's reflective of a refined practice, you know.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, what kind of knowledges do you immediately kind of evoke or participate in with people who are non-professional musicians, right? So the young women in, I think, was it in Chiapas or maybe it's in Veracruz, I can't remember.
Yeah, Entre Mujeres, okay. In Veracruz.
Yeah, and the boys in the detention center, you know, I'm curious what immediately inspired you or was interesting to you about what they bring as an archive of knowledge to those experiences, or is that difficult to pull out, you know, in terms of those short encounters?
I really enjoy, me personally, I really enjoy hearing people's stories, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a people person, right? I like having conversations. I'm a musician, you know, I like telling stories. I'm not looking to people to give me ideas or anything like that. But I've, over the years, I think that, in especially those two examples, to me, I really wanted, okay, so for the juvenile detention center, I really wanted to have them sort of, I knew a lot of them were, you know, they come into the room and a lot of them are sad. It was actually during kind of near Thanksgiving. And although, because they're all underage, they can't leave. If they're released, they can't leave. A parent has to come and pick them up. And some of them didn't get picked up, right? It was a little after Thanksgiving. So it was really sad to sort of, like, some of them were really heavy hearts. They were there because they'd rather be there than be staring at blocks, you know. So they were just, you know. So some of them were sad. So I felt like, as a performer, I felt the responsibility to sort of make them happy or get them laughing or, you know, get them involved, right? I was like the cheerleader. So that's one thing. I like hearing their stories. I want to take them out of their heads at the same time and then give them the, right? Unfortunately, I kind of put myself in that performative thing. But what ends up happening sort of takes over whether or not I want it to or not, right? Some of them would talk about really serious things, you know, or getting, you know, calling other inmates out, you know, or things like that, right? So I can't really control everything, but I can't have them sort of step outside of themselves. And maybe come up with something. What are we thinking about right now? You know, these are all topics that they came up with, you know. As far as Entre Mujeres, one of the biggest things I had to do was try to convince him that it doesn't have to be about women. You can write anything you want, you know. Some of them said, I'm not going to participate if my family doesn't participate. I'm not a feminist. Why would I, you know, I love my husband and I love my child. If my son, husband and child can't participate, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to be a part of this. And so I have to quickly, you know, damage control, like, no, it's not about that. I'm just bringing focus to nothing but women in this movement was almost like offensive to some of the women even, right? Definitely to some of the men. Some of the participants had to ask permission from their husbands to participate. Others like that. So I found that really interesting and sort of like to hear their stories and how they're thinking. It challenged me to think about, like, did I say feminist at any point in this process? And I never did. But that's what they got, because it was nothing. I was asking for only women's participation. So I thought that was interesting. It got me reflecting on my own language and really, you know, so I think that I'm always challenged. It's always unexpected. And I always come away with something, a feeling of like, wow, music is really powerful. I don't come up with melodies. When the music is playing and I was, do you guys hear that? What can we put to these lyrics? And I just kind of recite them and people start coming with melodies together. And it's, that's the weirdest thing too. It's almost like magic. It's really, and there have been times where nobody really wants to participate. Some people are skeptical. They're not really, and I have to sort of try to kick it into gear. And, you know, sometimes it worked better than others, but for the most part, it's always really interesting to sort of let my own aesthetic values also go, where I think the melody should go a certain way, or I think we should use this word, or I already have a chorus in my head, and they're not coming up with something, and I have to sort of relinquish the power in that and say, like, they have to come up with it. And that's really difficult to do. So it's all a matter of me being able to check myself and not impose my own aesthetic choices and not set an agenda that before they do.
Do you think there are any markers around like particular cultures that just come out of people? I mean, certainly the young boys are seeing like the hip hop vibe, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the LA, what I don't know, if, like there are other Chicano or Latino right. or African American yeah. things, and you use Afro Cubano in the yeah. drum, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm wondering about that cultural element.
Yeah, there. Yeah. You know, in the we didn't go towards the hip hop thing. They started doing that on their own, which I didn't predict, but I could tell that that's the kind of stuff they like when we took a tally of who likes what. And then for the señoras, for example, some of them wanted to do. We did another workshop that day, which was cumbias. They love cumbias in the barrio, right, in Boyle Heights. It's a danceable tune. People want to celebrate, no matter what the topic is. You know, they want to celebrate. That's very prominent in a lot of Latino communities. Actually, they don't like to feel sad. From what I, some have written really serious things, but it's always, you know, and we try to come up with a consensus. Sometimes people are like, you know, we want a cumbia, and other folks say, no, I want to let's do a ballad. You know, and there's disagreements and we have to sort of vote and it happens. But there's a range, I would say. But usually in East LA, the señoras like barrio or rancheras. And, right? And in, for youth, it's the hip hop or a lot of like sort of like hard rock or kind of ballad type stuff. You know? Yeah, depends.
Just conscious of the time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Nobody, one last question?
You don't have to. I just looked at you.
I've got a question.
Yes, sir.
You, just there you mentioned, for example, settling disagreements but via vote. And it was one thing that I was wondering about, which is that how do you actually negotiate like strong differences of opinion? I mean, while I've never tried collective songwriting, I have tried collective writing as part of a group,
yeah.
And writing by committee was probably one of the worst experiences I've ever had. You know, it's incredibly yeah. difficult, everyone yeah. disagrees, and it's very difficult yeah. to negotiate those sorts of
yeah.
tensions and so on. Yeah. So I was just wondering, obviously in extreme settings you just have to come down to vote, you said, but yeah, what are the various steps there?
So I always have, it's funny because I need to write about this because I realize that, actually, Maria Rosario Jackson, I did a workshop in her class at ASU, and she said, you do something during it. She's like, you need to write about that because the way you negotiate energies in the room and what you did, that's a kind of labor. Have you written about that? And I said, no, I haven't, actually. She's like, because, you know, and so anyhow, there's always somebody in the room who's already a writer, you know? And they come out, they're like, el coro, right? Porque la vida es una, un momento y tenemos que salir adelante con la justicia. Like, you know, they have this line. And I'm like, oh, shit. I was like, okay, how can I take her energy and not kill her vibe, right? Not kill the lady's vibe, but then also sort of like, oh, man, that was amazing. Okay, if I do this on Thursday, you guys are gonna know that was me. No, but I say, how can, okay, chingon, that's amazing. But okay, but I want to hear from other people as well, because I really like, okay, I'm gonna write that down, and I'll write it down like she feels like, okay, we got it, that's it. And other people sort of feel shy by that. You know, they feel like they can't speak up. They're like, I don't have anything like that. My stuff sucks. And usually it's one quiet person that is a genius. Suddenly, at some point, they get the courage enough to speak, and their voice is quivering, but they say something, and everybody's like, whoa, that was all. And people are laughing and high-fiving each other. Dude, write that. Wait, can you say that? Or somebody else encourages somebody else in the process. It's really, and it's happened every time. At some point or other, it's happened more than once, and I realize that that's something it can happen in family, like people take on personalities, perhaps. That would be really interesting to find out, right? What happens in families. But the whole point is that my job is to mediate those energies. I facilitate these energies. I try to get the quiet one to talk a little bit more. I try to get the one who's vocal and it keeps interrupting to maybe tone it down a little bit and without killing her vibe. I try to get that other one that I can tell is like writing away and like getting all kinds of crazy ideas, you know, like I'm like, just tell us what you read. And one of the things that I like to do is say, whatever you offer up, you have to expect it to change. Because sometimes people say like, no, instead of I, say, let's say we. Or like, you know, or they change it up. Like, you know, they want to change the metaphor perhaps, or they want to change something. And so everybody's sort of prepared to, whatever it is that they offer, that it's going to change. And that's one of the rules. Another thing is that it's okay for us to have dialogues on why there are two competing ideas, right? And that's the whole point, right? When we get to talk deeper about the issue itself, right? Because really, oftentimes, I'm there because of an issue, right? So I'm trying to get them to talk about this issue, and sometimes they talk about things that they get really deep into an issue that no agenda could have predicted, right? They're not linear thoughts, they're erratic, sort of, because they're writing songs, so they're in song mode, but they're still having these discussions that are need to be sort of mediated, right? And so the energy part is really something I'm just trying to, I'm better at it some days than others, you know? And what I try to teach my students as I teach these in one of their final projects is that I model it throughout the semester. Whether we're discussing a reading, we write a song about the reading. If we're talking about something else, their final project is that they need to go out into a community and conduct a collective songwriting workshop. And they're not musicians. But because I place more of an emphasis on process than the outcome, they come up with something. SoundCloud is out there. They use SoundCloud bites. Is that what it's called, SoundCloud? They're like all these beats. And so they'll give the student, you know, whatever community they go into, they use SoundCloud. And this is the song they came up with. And it's just, it's an adventure for everybody. And they have a criteria, and they have to manage energies. And so I kind of make that clear. But yeah. Sometimes it's easier than other times. And oftentimes, and it's really great when everybody agrees on something and everybody's excited because they're like, yeah, that's what we're trying to say. Yeah, yeah, okay, let's do it again. And, you know, and then we sing the song. And so that part is really, like, magical. I'm like, wow, it worked today. That was smooth. And other times I'm like, oh, my God, how am I going to do this? How am I going to finish this up and make it nice and tight, you know? So anyway. Thank you all for so much for your questions and for your attention.
Thank you.